I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Let's say you're 18 years old and you have committed the worst crime imaginable. You killed another person. So when the jury finds you guilty of first-degree murder, depending on where you live, the judge has a couple of choices. There's the death penalty, or there's life behind bars, a life sentence without any hope of parole, a sentence that says you will, in effect, die in a cell. Now, the death penalty leaves no room for second chances, and that's one of the reasons why so many people question it today. A life sentence without parole is also supposed to be a final solution, but lately that's being questioned as well. Connection listeners, what do you do with a person locked away at age 18 who, after 40-some years of exemplary behavior, perhaps at the age of 60, is judged to have genuinely turned his life around? Is there or should there be room for a second chance? Our number's 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. And we start today with Daniel Bergner. He's the author of the book called God of the Rodeo, The Search for Hope, Faith, and a Six-Second Ride in Louisiana's Angola Prison. And he's also been writing lately about the people who are sentenced to life without parole, sentenced to die behind bars. Daniel, welcome to the program.
Thanks very much for having me on.
I wonder if we can start with an example. You were telling people here about the story of Kerry Lassane, for example. Is he a good example of the sort of thing we're talking about?
I think he's a fair example. Two decades ago, Lassane, who was a teenager at the time, killed horribly another teenager. Lassane was robbing a gas station. His victim was the attendant. The victim was on his knees. That 17-year-old boy was pleading for his life, and Lassane shot him through the head. There is no reducing the horror of what he did. Two decades later, though, Lassane has worked himself up to the most trusted level of inmate at Louisiana's Angola Prison, which functions as a vast farm. And in his work on that farm, he's given not only a lot of freedom of movement within the prison, which are about, the grounds are about the size of Manhattan, but he's actually taken outside the prison, uncuffed, unguarded by anyone with a gun, to do the work of the farm. The warden of Angola has spoken of men like him, saying that there needs to be at least consideration of parole after a man has served 20 or 25 years. Men like him have been offered work outside the prison should they ever be pardoned. The men closest to these convicts, the men who are by no means bleeding hearts, know what this country now refuses to acknowledge, that life without parole sentences deny the human capacity for change. And we need to look at ourselves and look at that ability for self-transformation.
Let's go back to that moment when the sentence is handed down, Daniel, because judges and juries and people who speak about that at those particularly emotional moments are very, very specific that this person, whether we're talking about Kerry Lassane or someone else, has done something so awful that the best thing society can do, either to protect itself or to punish that criminal or for whatever combination of reasons it might be, revenge, retribution, is to put that person away and then add those words, without parole. Then if we follow your logic, then the whole without parole thing has no meaning.
Well, but that doesn't mean that we're talking about the old phrase, the revolving door, or we're talking even about 10 years, 15 years, and you're out. Not at all. There's, of course, ways to write these laws that would talk of irreducible minimum sentences before parole was even considered. We could talk about 20 years, 30 years. For that matter, we could talk about 40 years before a man could be considered. Most of those men won't be freed, even when they are considered. But some, and that 31,000 or more serving this sentence, would indicate that many would, after a long time, be worthy of a second chance at freedom.
Let's talk again about Kerry Lassane. Now, does this fellow, he's what, in his late 30s, early 40s now?
Correct.
Does he feel that he has proved himself? Does he say, you know, I'm not the same person that I was when I came in? Or is this a case that's being made more by those who are around him? Where does it come from? See what I mean?
I think it comes, of course, from him. I mean, almost any convict after 20 years behind bars would want out. But it comes as well from the men who are most intimate, close contact with him, who get the chance to watch him day in and day out, the warden, the officials at the prison, the officials or even the outsiders who work with him through this work on the farm at Angola. But I don't think we should get locked to Carrie Lassane. We should talk about others. I hope we'll talk about Wilbert Rodeau, who I recently wrote about. There are many examples, I think, of men who could well be let out. And further, I think we should be talking about the principle. We're a society that puts value on people's ability to change. In fact, we've built our country on that faith and self-transformation. I think we need to acknowledge that even when it comes to the people who've done the very worst things.
Now, in your research, Daniel, you came across some statistics that made you stop and pause. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about how we've seen this life without parole change just over the last 10 years.
I did. When I first became aware of it was when I was down at Angola, Louisiana's maximum security penitentiary, writing about its natural lifers, and there are about 2,000 of them among its 5,000 inmates. But more recently, as I looked at statistics across the country, statistics that aren't very well studied but that are out there, there's a very marked trend. About a decade ago, there were about 12,000 inmates serving the natural life sentence. Now about 31,000 are serving it. A decade ago, 31 states had the sentence. Now 46 have it. So there's this real marked trend toward putting people away absolutely forever and, in a sense, forgetting about them forever, gaining a kind of moral luxury of not thinking about them ever again.
Now, you know this issue well enough to know that they're, you know, when people talk about these issues, often what they're talking about is the death penalty. Should the death penalty be used and in what situations? If there is some kind of softening in the United States on the death penalty, it seems in a way like this natural life sentence, the life sentence without parole, is becoming the alternative.
I think that's right. I think one of the ironies is that the anti-death penalty movement has, in a sense, offered up life no parole or put great emphasis on that in their campaigns as a way to answer a need for ultimate severity, answer a need for ultimate finality. I think that's unfortunate. I understand why the anti-death penalty movement has done it, but I don't think from a moral perspective that's the right thing. I think we're, as a society, we're just better than that.
And do you look at this primarily from a moral perspective? Because there are the other issues that it's, you know, it's very expensive to keep a 65-year-old man in jail, that, you know, this person might be able to make a contribution to society. Do you come back to the moral issue, the question about the second chance?
I really do. I think it's fundamentally a moral question about who we are. I hope we'll take a pause and look at ourselves. I mean, if I can just quote the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, who in a statement against this trend of abandoning parole say the following: the common good is undermined by criminal behavior that threatens the lives and dignity of others and by policies that seem to give up on those who have broken the law. We are convinced that our tradition and faith offer better alternatives that can hold offenders accountable and challenge them to change their lives, and that reach out to victims and reject vengeance. I'm not coming to this from a particularly religious perspective, mm-hmm. but I offer that up just as an example of how moral thinkers are taken aback by this trend.
Daniel, stay with us for a minute, if you would. I'd like to bring Dan Levy into the conversation. He's the president of a national organization called Parents of Murdered Children, and he's joining us from a studio in Tempe, Arizona. Hi, Dan.
Hi, good morning.
You've had a chance to listen in, and perhaps what I should do, Dan, to just to introduce you to the listeners is to get you to tell us the story, not of a child of yours, but of your brother, Howard. Can you do that for us?
I sure will. As you said, I am the national president for Parents of Murdered Children, which is also for the friends and family of those that have died by violence. And my brother, Howard Levy, was 40 years old, married, two kids, master's degree, and went to play a game of basketball on an early Sunday morning in November of 1996 here in Phoenix, which was a regimen that he had done for over 10 years at the same elementary school. And at 7 o'clock in that morning, as he was waiting for his friends to show up, he was accosted and shot at point-blank range by what we now know to be two gang members, thrown out of the car and left there to die, and subsequently did. And that's it in a real Reader's Digest version.
Now, the killers were caught. In fact, the man who shot your brother was convicted of first-degree murder. Is that right?
Yes. He actually pled the first-degree murder. And in lieu of that, they dropped the death penalty on him. And the co-defendant received 15 years.
So he's serving just the sort of sentence that I'm talking about with Daniel. He's serving life without parole.
Well, in Arizona, and this is a suggestion maybe for Daniel to pursue, in Arizona we actually have three sentences for first-degree murder. One is the death penalty, one is natural life, and the other is life, but no less than 25, meaning that they are eligible after 25 years,
right.
And that is what he pled to.
Tell me what you think from your position, either your professional role with the association or personally, about the idea that someone serving a natural life sentence deserves a second chance.
Well, from my position and in the people that I work with, I do believe that there is an element in our society that having worked in the criminal justice system and gone through it as a victim, I know that if somebody is convicted of first-degree murder, that it's a pretty high scrutiny and that they committed, obviously, heinous crimes. And I believe that if you take a life of somebody, you pretty much have given up your chance to be rehabilitated, at least on the outside. I have no problem with people on the inside making their lives different and having an impact. But to me, it's almost like a Monday morning quarterback, if you will. Once you're incarcerated and given a life sentence, it's great to see changes in people, but we need to remember the victim who doesn't have the opportunity to come back.
And what's the role in that decision, Dan, from your perspective of the victim's family in making that determination? Is it then society's decision to make, or 20, 40 years after a crime's committed, does the victim's family still have a role in the fate of the person in prison?
Well, I think by all means the victim's family should have a role and should have a voice in that decision. And not to say that if they feel that the person should be released, then, and if there's the ability to do that through sentencing or release methods, then maybe that should be a mitigating factor. But for the most part, I feel the victims, and certainly in Mr. Rideau's case where the victim doesn't want him to get out, I think that's where it should end.
Daniel Bergner, just briefly, because we're coming up to a break, but in the case of giving the victims' families that sort of right, does that factor in when you're looking at it from a moral perspective?
Absolutely, and I should make clear, I've spent time during my research with victims' families. I've heard from the victims of Lassane's murder and been devastated by those stories. It should factor in, but in the end, it is that need for retribution, that need for forgetting, absolutely understandable when it comes from the victim's point of view, should not dictate policy when it comes to a criminal justice system. And there's a real difference between empathizing and understanding a victim's need and determining how we as a society are going to punish convicts.
I'm glad you made that distinction, because it should be clear to our listeners that we're neither casting you nor Dan Levy as people who are on one side of these issues. Anybody involved with this knows that these are tough and difficult decisions that have both sides that can be argued. Connection listeners, we're talking about the life sentence without parole. Are these a good alternative to the death penalty? Do they unfairly lock the door on any kind of redemption? Join us. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio, and we're talking this hour about the life sentence without parole and the way that it's growing in America and whether or not it ought to be looked at in terms of providing some window, some opportunity for a second chance, or whether or not it should be just left exactly as it's stated. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. And with me on the program, we have Dan Levy. He's president of the National Organization of Parents of Murdered Children. Daniel Bergner is a writer who writes for the New York Times Magazine, Harper's, other publications. Put an op-ed piece in the New York Times earlier this week called When Forever is Far Too Long, and has actually written a book about the years that he spent researching the prison system. And I want you both, if you can, to weigh in on a question where I certainly end up on this, and I suspect a number of our listeners do, and that is the danger that even if you take the case of Carrie Lassane, who looks like he's turned his life around, or Wilbur Rideau, who after 42 years of having an impeccable record in prison, you know, appears to be the best example of someone who has turned his life around. What if you let someone like that out and you're wrong? What if the whole thing was somebody just, you know, working the system, trying to make sure that they looked really good, and Daniel, a month after they get out there in a bar and they get in trouble and they get in a fight and they hurt somebody? I mean, isn't that where people kind of seize up on this idea?
I think it's partly where people seize up on it, but not completely. Let me just address the part that by which they do worry about that. You know, when we talk about Wilbur Rideau, and I think we should just very briefly lay out his situation as sex, I'm interested in what Dan Levy would say about him. We're not talking about someone who has had any sign of violent behavior within prison. In fact, he's turned himself from a ninth-grade dropout over those 42 years into an award-winning journalist, and his only infraction, 42 years in prison, has been the possession of a contraband item, and that item was a bottle of Whiteout. We're not talking about murders like Abbott, who were, you know, vouched for by Norman Mailer years ago and who had violent prison records. And sure enough, they got out and committed murder yet again. We're talking about creating a mechanism and a principle by which men who've committed murder long in the past can have their records examined, their transformations examined in prison, and then a decision can be made. The decision can be made to keep them in. And that decision will probably be made for most of them. But for many among those 31,000, and that's a significant number, their records will be studied. And it will be clear, as in Rideau's case, that as a 61-year-old man, he is a man of utter self-restraint and accomplishment who is not a risk. And I could quote you any number of Louisiana prison officials who would confirm this, who is not a risk for future violence.
Dan.
Well, you know, to speak of Mr. Rideau's case, you know, obviously anybody that's incarcerated for life and does positive things, you know, I would be naive if I said that wasn't, you know, impressive and good. But the reality is he was punished, obviously, for the crime he committed, not for what he's doing now in prison. And, you know, if we revisit this 25, 30, 40 years down the line, it, in many cases, re-victimizes victims in that they have to go to these hearings and they have to conjure up images that they thought were long buried, and yet it never goes away. And so I do think no matter what their record is in prison, if they're given a life sentence, I do feel they could be a threat on the outside. They're in a captive environment for the most part. We don't know what they will do on the outside. And they killed once, which is the highest crime there is. And from my position, and I believe from many crime victims, I certainly don't speak for all homicide survivors, but I think that they can be productive, they can give back to society. But why this need to release them? Baffled by that.
Let's if we can, bring in one more voice, and this perhaps will be someone who can sketch in a part of the story that we're searching for. Roger Thomas is joining us on the line. He's currently deputy warden at the York County Prison in Pennsylvania. Before he moved to York, he was assistant warden at the Louisiana State Penitentiary in Angola. And Roger, if I do my math correctly, you've had 27 years in the warden business. Is that right?
I haven't added it up, but it's about there, yes.
Tell me, in your view, whether or not the transformation can take place between someone who can commit such a cold-blooded murder as shooting someone through the head who's on his knees begging for forgiveness, a transformation can take place in such a dramatic way that that person ought to be considered for release.
Well, in my opinion, that it does. Crime is a young man's game. Now, that doesn't mean that only young men commit it, but it's far more likely to be young men than young women. It's far more likely to be young men than old men. It's a young man's game. And predominantly when the testosterone's raging through these men's systems and they commit these terrible, violent acts. Now, the man that goes into jail at age 18 or 19 is a totally different human being than the one you see at 61 or 62.
Now, does that mean, though, that the person should not be given a sentence of life without parole? I'm trying to imagine what's in the head of the inmate, or where the punishment fits here, or how much of this is meant to be deterrence for other people if they're considering some sort of crime. Because we're not talking about that sort of transformation taking place universally. I mean, not a whole lot of inmates end up as eligible for this kind of reconsideration.
Well, I'm going to look at it from a different way. I've been a prison administrator for the majority of my adult life. Locking somebody up and throwing away the key is a very expensive luxury. We have turned our prisons into large geriatric wards. And when you get these individuals who are 60, 61, 60, whatever, in their 70s, into their 80s, and you're warehousing them into prisons, you're talking about expensive upkeep. These individuals require a tremendous amount of medical care. They require a tremendous amount of nursing care. And you're talking about spending a lot of money. Now, it's okay with me. I have made my living as a prison administrator. My salary's doubled in the past 10 years. And the reason why it's doubled is because there's more and more inmates coming in with longer and longer sentences. As a consequence, I have more inmates to take care of, and we must get better at our jobs, particularly if you're going to take away hope.
Roger, just hang with us for a minute, because I want to hear from Dan Levy on this idea of the geriatric institution and whether or not the cost, Dan, should be a factor here in this conversation.
Well, from my perspective, it's money well spent, and there is an element in this society, I'm sorry, but it's a small element, but those that get to that first-degree murder, that means theirs wasn't pled from first to second, which many do get pled down from. These are the ones that the judge and jury determined need to be put away. And as far as the cost, I mean, somebody that's been incarcerated for 40 or 50 years, when they come out, who do you think is going to wind up paying for their geriatrics or health care anyways? It's probably going to be some state-funded health care system, if at all. Or if they don't have insurance, it's certainly going to be passed to the consumer. So I don't really buy that argument.
Roger, give me another perspective of yours from the warden's chair. I think that when people have this debate across kitchen tables, that the assumption is that the worst punishment you can give is the death penalty, and the second worst that you can give is life without parole. Do you see it that way?
I have never seen it that way. I have been involved in 19 executions. In fact, the first two in Louisiana, 1983, I lifted off the chair. The death penalty is quick. It's quick and it's cool. The second thing is death row. Death row inmates usually live in a quiet, secluded spot in the prison. You always put your best officers there. You don't put these young bucks that are going to go in there and agitate them. So you have good, reasonable, responsible officers assigned to death row who generally leave these inmates alone. The problem is it's very difficult to explain that the public gets its pound of flesh. And I'm not opposed to them having it. They get it. And the problem is that we're never able to describe it to them of just how horrible life in prison is. It works. I mean, the person... In which the individual who killed Mr. Levy's brother is miserable. I guarantee it. He's miserable. Mr. Levy is getting the retribution that I would feel if someone killed somebody in my family. Now, it's very difficult to explain that to Mr. Levy because Mr. Levy's going to say he's still alive to feel it. My brother's dead. He's still alive to watch a television show. He's still alive to eat a dinner. All of these things that his brother wasn't allowed and doesn't have. And I understand that. And it's more like trying to explain a pebble in a shoe. You put a quarter inch pebble in a shoe, and you say, well, and when you put this thing in his shoe, and when he walks on it, he's slightly uncomfortable, and the public would look at you and go, well, boy, that doesn't sound like too bad. I mean, that's no big deal. Holy mackerel, that's nothing. Well, you know, 8 years later, his foot fell off.
So should Mr. Levy, as the person who is trying to balance this and make sense of it and live with all that frustration and pain and agony of losing a brother, have a say in the fate of the person in the prison? You've seen both sides of that. What's your view?
My view is yes, but it can't be the end-all and only answer. The victim and the victim's family cannot have 100% total say forever and ever, amen. Now, that doesn't mean it isn't taken into consideration. It doesn't mean that it doesn't count. It doesn't mean that it isn't given serious weight. But to be the only thing that's taken into consideration, why have a justice system at all? Let Mr. Levy handle the discipline and the punishment and the retribution.
Daniel Bergner, do you want to jump in here?
I did, just on one point that Mr. Levy made earlier, and which is this distinction between the life sentence with this 25-year minimum and the life without parole sentence. And that is, you know, he's perfectly laying out what I think I and perhaps Warden Thomas would prefer to see. And that is that 25-year minimum, fine. Then there's a mechanism for redemption, which is so, you know, fundamental to our culture. I'm suggesting that to completely close the door is really, it's beneath us, because what we're seeing is men, again, like Wilbert Rideau, totally transformed, winners, named Person of the Week by ABC News, named Most Rehabilitated Prisoner in the Country by Life Magazine. I could go on and on here. That men like that can't fundamentally change. They can't remake themselves, that they don't deserve a second chance at the age of 62. And I think that I'm just wondering, would even Mr. Levy really say that a man like that should never have the chance to take those first steps back into our world?
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Dan Levy, your chance to speak on
Well,
that.
And, you know, even a guy like I, I'm one of the most compassionate people, if you can imagine that. And I feel that, you know, somebody like Mr. Rideau, like I said earlier, I don't understand the fixation of why we need to let him go, or people like him. And in Arizona, like I said, we do have life less than 25, but we also have the natural life population. So, you know, there are people in there that may be doing the same exact thing as Mr. Rideau, but they're in there for natural life. And I think those came about because of laws that legislators enacted, which represent the populace, obviously. And if, it, in fact, the population in America feels that there should be a lesser sentence than natural life like there is in Arizona,
right,
then, you know, I support that. And I would point out that, you know, even as great as Mr. Rideau sounds, he also smuggled political biographies in. He's now going to change his confession and lie to abandon his confession. Doesn't that go to the type of person we're talking about?
I don't actually want to get too far down the story of Mr. Rideau, because it's a chance for us to bring some of our callers in on the program. Let's go first to Jim, who's calling in from Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, Jim.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. Thank you for calling.
I want to make a comment that I 100% agree with the warden. Over 20 years ago, when my testosterone was pumping and I was a young kid in junior high school, I thought it would be a cool idea to burn my school down so that I could have a few days off from school, not thinking about the consequences of the people who might have been killed. Luckily enough, a teacher put out the fire. No one knew that I had tried to do it, and now 20-something years later, I would never have even thought or think of attempting to do something like that. And I'm a model citizen. I pay my taxes. I have a home and a family. And I just think that when these young kids who shoot people or do bad things, I don't think they should be tried as adults. I think they're only kids. And I was only a kid at the time who didn't know what I was doing, didn't think about what I was doing. And if I had, you know, if I had done what I had attempted to do, a lot of people would have been killed, and people might have looked at me like I was some kind of, you know, crazy person, but I'm not, and I was just a young kid who was just ignorant.
Jim, is it all about age? I mean, if you were 22 when you tried to set fire to the building, or 24, or 26, or 28, I mean, is that what we need to do, is try and find a way of dividing the young and stupid from the older and stupid?
I just think that kids, like the warden said, young kids with testosterone pumping through their veins do things and don't think about the consequences, and they may not be bad people. I'm not a bad person. I've never committed any crimes other than obviously attempting to burn down my school, but I didn't do it because I wanted to kill people. I thought because it would be cool to have my school burned down and I could have a few days off from school. I was dumb. I was young and I was dumb, but I'm a model citizen now. And
if I can go to Roger Thomas on this and ask the warden whether or not there is a time when you see this kind of maturity setting in, even inside prison.
Yes. Now, in every single case, no. But in lots and lots of cases, it does happen. Look at yourself. Are you the same individual at your age that you were when you were in your late teens? I knew Wilbur Rito. I knew him. I worked with him every day for years. I am in favor of Wilbur Rito getting out. And the reason why I'm in favor of it is because at the time he entered the institution, he was told by everybody, by the administration, by society in general, by the court system, that if you go in there and you try to make something of yourself and you keep clean and you try to do the right thing, that someday you will get out. And he did. He did that. The problem was that he did it too well. He did it so well that he made a name for himself, and now all of the people that went into jail at the same time as him, they're out, and he's stuck there. It's a different human being. My feeling about Wilbur Rito has nothing to do with whether or not he can write an article. I'm not that good at journalism. I can't tell a good writer from a bad writer. What I will tell you is that on a day-to-day basis, working with Wilbur Rito, he didn't lie to me about telephone calls. He didn't lie to me about the little things. The little things is what makes a man. Sometimes people go in and they deal with these individuals and they're charmed by them, and then they want to come out and say he's rehabilitated, and the administration looks at him and goes, hey, this guy's not to be let out of jail.
Mr. Thomas, I have to stop you there. We're stepping away for a break. Thanks for being with us on the program.
Okay.
Roger Thomas, Deputy Warden of the York County Prison in York, Pennsylvania. We're back with more after the break. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. This hour, we're talking about the life sentence without parole. With me on the program, Dan Levy. His brother Howard was murdered by a gang member, and Dan is now president of the National Organization of Parents of Murdered Children. That's an organization of some 100,000 members. He calls it a club nobody really wants to belong to. Daniel Bergner is also with us. He spent almost 2 years visiting Angola Prison in Louisiana for his book, God of the Rodeo, The Search for Hope, Faith, and a Six-Second Ride in Louisiana's Angola Prison. And he writes frequently for the New York Times Magazine, Harper's, and other publications. Our number is 1-800-423-8255 for you to join us. Let's go to Charleston, South Carolina. John is on the line. Hi, John.
Hi, Dick. I love your show.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you. I have a comment. As a society, I think we need to decide, you know, if we're going to punish prisoners or rehabilitate them, because if we're going to rehabilitate prisoners, it's a whole different system than what we have right now.
Does it have to be a choice, John? Does it have to be either one or the other?
Well, I think so, because, you know, when you're talking about taking a murderer and releasing him, I mean, that's about the worst crime somebody can commit.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you can rehabilitate a murderer, certainly you can rehabilitate anyone.
Daniel Bergner, is this a way that the moral choice breaks down in your perspective as well?
I think we can certainly do both. I think there's, as Warden Thomas eloquently put it, prison is a place for both. It is a severe punishment. It's also a place where we could rehabilitate. We could certainly do a better job of that, but there's certainly even now a chance for that rehabilitation coming inside a prison. One thing I'd like to comment on here and is to go back to your lead opening the show about this sentence being used for juveniles, because that sort of crystallizes it, puts the severity of the situation in its clearest form. I mean, there is a very marked trend here over the last decade or even going back further of increasing use of this sentence, and now it's being used increasingly for kids who committed crimes at 14, 15, who have no chance of parole. I think we've heard from wardens about this, heard from religious figures about this. We can talk about European systems of justice. None of the Western European countries who we draw our legal heritage from, none of them have this natural life sentence. Or I should correct myself there. Britain has it in some very few cases. They're using it for 20 current inmates as opposed to our 31,000. Mm-hmm. All we need to do is just take a pause, look at ourselves. This is not something we need.
Dan Levy, I'd like to hear you on John's point about rehabilitation versus punishment, because it seems to me that if it's about rehabilitation, then once the sentence is handed down as representatives of victims, you're kind of out of the picture. But if it's about punishment, then the victim's family and friends then remain a part of the picture. Is it personal like that?
Well, I think for, at least in the case of murder, I do believe that rehabilitation for 95% of the prison population is should be the focus of prisons instead of warehousing them and letting prisoners sit there. There should be programs to get them ready for when they are released. But it is personal for a homicide survivor in the sense that, first of all, you do have an impact at sentencing when you can give a victim impact statement. But once you know that that perpetrator is locked up, it is a huge, huge relief to most victims to know that they don't have to worry, continue to worry.
And 40 years later, does that victim's relative then lose some right to have a say on the future of that person? That's really what it comes down to, doesn't it?
One thing that's gotten lost in this conversation, are the victims, and that 40, 50 years down the line.
Well, they're not lost in the conversation. You're representing them very well.
Well, thank you. But I meant as far as, to me, the focus should be on the victims. And I think very much that the ripple effect of crime is devastating to talk to a parent of a murdered child. That's where our focus should be on, not on, in my mind, for the 5% of lifers who are in there. And that's just my perspective. And it's not necessarily the view of parents of murdered children, but it's the position of Dan Levy. And, like I said earlier, they're in there for the crime that they did and not for, there's no mitigation when you're given natural life. And I think once you're there, you're there.
Daniel, you've thought a lot about this. How do you square respecting the prisoner and respecting the victim's family at the same time?
Well, I think the honest answer is I can't square it. Mr. Levy's right. The pain of a woman who was shot alongside the woman that Wilbert Rideau killed, the pain of the parents of Carrie Lassane's teenage victim, there's no squaring that. That's infinite pain. My only point is that beyond a certain point, that pain and that need for never thinking again, and it's an understandable need, and that need for vengeance, and vengeance is a crude word for something that's, again, completely understandable here, those needs of those victims' family can't ultimately determine the way our society goes. If they did, we would be a society just governed by a need for vengeance and a need for finality, and we're a much more thoughtful country than that, I hope.
All right. Thanks for that. And, John, thanks for your call. 1-800-423-8255 to join us. Let's go next to Brookline, Massachusetts. Elliot's on the line. Hi, Elliot.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I'm a psychiatrist, and I'm a consultant to a penal system as part of my job. And while I agree with Mr. Bergner about the capacity for prisoners as well as everybody else to change, obviously, and therefore that our sentences shouldn't be irrevocable, I would raise a question, Dick, in response to one thing that you said, which is the scenario about the sociopath who's basically been looking like a model prisoner because he's trying to fool everyone. I think a more profound concern about releasing some people based on them looking like a model prisoner is that it was the structure and relative lack of stimulation and lack of challenge of the institutional setting that kept their noses clean, and that after they're released, the the freedom will be too much of a challenge for them, especially because there isn't much rehabilitation going on behind bars these days. And I think that it would call for, I mean, I've seen people, not certainly murderers, but I've seen people who have a strong unconscious motive to put themselves in a very restrictive, institutionalized setting with limited choices. And in that setting, they can operate fine, but not in the setting of the unrestricted real world.
So, Elliot, are you saying that the people who look like they would be candidates for release are really only successful in an institution and perhaps ought to stay there, or that we need a system or some way of moving them out?
Yeah, I think that the discussion ought to focus more on how you would adequately assess somebody to deal with such concerns. The other point that I would make is some of the comments before about focusing on juveniles are very apt. If anything, change is not incremental over a 30 or 40 year sentence. I would argue that the greatest amount of change and personality development will happen in the earliest years of a person's sentence. And after they're an adult, their personality is largely fixed, and one could expect less change over the subsequent 20 or 30 years than one could at the beginning. So I think the...
Elliot, I want to pick up the part that you were talking about earlier about the difficulty of surviving on the outside, even after being particularly successful on the inside. Daniel, I'm sure you've talked to examples of people who might look like they'd be great on the outside, but themselves may even have serious reservations about whether or not they could succeed outside the institutional walls that they live in.
Sure, it's a very good point. But again, in an odd way, Louisiana's maximum security penitentiary provides a good answer to this because as severe as Louisiana's penal rules are, it does allow for some of this travel outside the prison grounds. In a case like Rideau's, he's a good example. He's traveled to talk to Boy Scouts, traveled to talk to civic groups, traveled to Washington, addressed newspaper editors. Let me take another example, though. There's an inmate I followed who'd been in for 20-odd years, Myron Hodges, spent his time literally bathing quadriplegics on Angola's prison ward and also traveling with an inmate band. It's not as though, and traveling off the grounds, it's not as though there aren't signs that these men could well function outside. And I think also we need to be aware, again, to come back to earlier point, that these men are closely observed by a very skeptical group, corrections officer, and these men have been deemed able to function outside by that very conservative and skeptical group.
Dan Levy, the man who shot your brother Howard, did he ever say he was sorry for that?
No, he never, even for his own mitigation at sentencing, uttered, "I'm sorry," and has had multiple infractions since being incarcerated and is a gang member in prison, and there was no remorse.
And would that have made a difference to you or to anyone?
It would have. It certainly would have with me, not in any way excusing it, obviously, but in the 2 years that he was waiting to being sentenced, it would have shown me that he realized the magnitude of what he did and that my brother's life wasn't just discardable and wasn't meaningless like he made it seem.
Did you want him put to death?
They had filed the death penalty. I had no problem with that, knowing the long appeals that would come with it. I wouldn't have had a problem with it.
And you didn't have a feeling one way or the other, like put him away for life or the death penalty either way?
Initially when they filed the death penalty, I supported it. When the plea was offered and it was dropped, I understood it. But you got to remember that this man had absolutely no reason to kill my brother and to take away a father and a son and a friend to many and a husband. And so from my point of view, the death penalty would have been appropriate, and it met the legal qualifications for pecuniary gain, cruel and heinous, and so on and so on.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Dan, the reason I'm asking you the question is, if there is a shift in America happening away from the death penalty towards life without parole, and let's not talk about your brother specifically here, but in more general terms, are you saying that look, if that shift happens, let's make sure those people are locked away and kept away, because the punishment aspect of it matters.
Yeah, I am. I am okay if the death penalty went away, if that's what, you know, the citizens of the United States wanted. You know, I'm okay with that. I just feel that, and it's almost for me not a point of whether they could function if they got out as lifers. I mean, that is a good point, but it's more of should they? And I think that's the crux of the question. And, you know, from my perspective, and I would argue from many homicide survivors' perspective, no.
Daniel Bergner, just looking at it from the complete opposite perspective, if it ever comes to pass that people who are put away for life without parole start to get that second chance, isn't there a risk that society would go, that's not what we wanted, and go back to the death penalty?
Sure, there's a slight risk, but again...
Not a big one in your mind, eh?
I don't think it's huge, and I think that we need to confront that. I think we need to confront the moral issues involved. But again, I want to say, I mean, listening to Mr. Levy, one, I'm terribly sorry. Two, I agree that remorse is key and needs to be not only expressed but lived by inmates. And I think that a system that would allow for rehabilitation and repentance would be exactly the kind of system that would encourage that kind of depth of remorse that would allow for transformation.
I want to say to both of you that you've given us that opportunity to look at this issue from both a personal and a way of understanding that when we're talking about death penalty in prison, we're talking about people's lives and personal feelings. So thanks to both of you for joining us. Daniel Bergner, thanks for being with us.
Thanks very much.
Daniel's author of God of the Rodeo, The Search for Hope, Faith, and a Six-Second Ride in Louisiana's Angola Prison. Dan Levy, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Dan is president of the National Organization of Parents of Murdered Children. Earlier in the program, we heard from Roger Thomas, deputy warden of the York County Prison in York, Pennsylvania. He was also part of the warden staff in Angola Prison in Louisiana. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.